You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I'm thrilled, actually, to be speaking with an old friend. We met when I was the head of a school, and Paul was a parent. Paul Irving was a parent at the school, and he was foolish enough to say yes when I asked him to join the board, and it began a long friendship. And so, Paul, thank you so much for being here and for being willing to do this. So thank you. Thank you.
And David, I just had to turn off my phone. It's what a pleasure to be with you. And you know, and I know that hanging out with you and being on your board was one of the great joys. So good seeing you.
Even through the tumult, plenty of. Good seeing you in your new digs in LA.
Yes,
so, cool. So let me give you a little bit of background. I am not going to read your entire bio because it's just way too impressive.
Sleep inducing, I'm sure.
But I will. Yeah. But I will just read a paragraph. And so Paul Irving, let's do this. So I'm looking somewhat as if I'm looking at the camera. Paul Irving is a corporate and nonprofit director and advisor to leaders in business, investment, philanthropy, and academia. He is the author, editor of The Upside of Aging, How Long Life is Changing the World of Health, Work, Innovation, Policy, and Purpose. He's a Wall Street Journal expert panelist and a contributor to the Harvard Business Review, PBS, Next Avenue, and Forbes. Paul speaks and writes about health, finance, and the future of retirement, innovation in the longevity economy, and the changing culture of aging in America and the world. So I know that after Paul stopped being an extraordinarily successful lawyer, and I think when you left, you were head of the whole shebang at Manatt Phelps and Phillips, which was a law firm only and then became a law and consulting firm. Blame Paul for that, or thank Paul for that, whichever you decide. And I don't know if it's important to speak about how you got to be somebody who thinks seriously about age and aging. Sure. But I would love to hear that piece of the story. And I know you went off to after retiring, you went off to Harvard, and they had a, well, you can tell that story. Anyway, thanks again for being here, and sure. Always, yeah. A treat.
Thank you, David. It's again great to be with you. So the Reader's Digest version is, I finished, you know, 3+ decades of slaving away as a lawyer, but running the firm. And I get this great opportunity to go off and do this fellowship at Harvard, which is focused on kind of reimagining later life. It's really, the idea is a number of older people have wisdom and judgment to ploy to use in new ways for social change, to help nonprofits, to engage in lifelong learning and the like. And so that was the genesis of this fellowship, which audaciously in Harvard ways is called an advanced leadership fellowship. I didn't make it up. There were words.
And the program still exists. Yeah,
the program still exists, and I'm actually on the board of a similar program at Stanford, which is called, kind of in audaciously Stanford ways, the Distinguished Careers Institute. And there are a number of these programs now proliferating across the country. And one of the things many of us who are advocates of lifelong learning are interested in is trying to democratize this notion, and try to to try to realize the potential of older students, the benefit of intergenerational student bodies, and frankly, the reality that with half of the colleges and universities in America at risk of failure in the next several decades because they're entirely dependent on tuition revenue from a smaller and smaller cohort of young people growing up because low birth rates, universities really have to think about lifelong learning, have to think about the benefits, not just of young students, but of old students and the potential of learning for all of us. But it's not just for teens and 20 somethings. It's for all of us and should be for all of us throughout life.
But the program, the leadership fellowship, was not focused on age and aging, right?
Not at all. No, people. I mean, it was really kind of an extraordinary group of people. I mean, in my cohort was the former transportation secretary of the United States in the Clinton administration, the former senior health officer of Switzerland, the former head of Trader Joe's, who, by the way, is now doing a really interesting nonprofit. He calls himself Grocer Doug Rao, and he's now doing a nonprofit. A series of really interesting and important healthy food initiatives in food deserts, starting Boston,
but now
moving across the country. You know, using what he knows about running a grocery store. And I was approached about a senior level position at the Milken Institute. The idea being, boy, here's significant nonprofit infrastructure. You can kind of do what you want, advance ideas you want. Initiate programs you want. I started the institute. Become its president. I'm doing a listening tour, which is what you do, right, when you start a new job. And the then head of development, it's a 501c3 public charity. He comes running into my office, and he says, one of our foundation sponsors is really interested in a media friendly, high impact, data driven. Project focused on population aging. And I said to him, really important relationship for us. Let's help them place this project with the right think tank, the right academic institution, the right place to do it. And he said, like most development guys would, oh no, I told him we'd love to do it. And Paul, you're getting kind of old. I thought you'd like to think it through. This is it's the absolute truth. So I had no background in this. I mean, I was interested in things like, you know, civil rights and civil liberties and legal services and various other things, had never done anything having to do with older people. So I panicked, you know, so we were kind of into this. I panicked and I picked up the phone and I called somebody who was my friend then and has become just a dear, dear friend of mine since, Mark Friedman, who was the founder of Encore.org, which board I chaired and sat on for many years. Now it's called CoGenerate. We're focused on older and younger people working together for social change. And I said, Mark, what do I do? And he said, well, you should call. And he gave me two names. This led to a project which was focused on the readiness of cities for the realities of demographic change, the realities of aging.
Well, can you speak a little bit about that? Because, like, you know, I think... I brought this conversation to be up with somebody here. And, well, you know, essentially the question was, why should we be thinking about that other than the fact that we all are aging? Yeah. But why should we be thinking about it? Why is it bigger than I just have to make sure I keep exercising?
It's a really important question. So there's a societal, social, macro answer to this and a personal answer to this. But let me focus on the macro for a minute. And David, I have to tell you, you don't like, what's the old adage about when you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So I apologize for the reality that I now kind of see things through this prism. But I genuinely believe that population aging is the second most important challenge that the world will face after climate change. Why do I say that? So across the world, and people know about this in Japan, for example, the first super age society in the world, but it's true throughout Asia, it's true throughout Europe, it's true throughout North America, it's very much remarkably true throughout South America, and will be true in sub-Saharan Africa, India, places that we think of as extraordinarily young today, that the intersection of longer lives and historically unprecedented low birth rates means that the population of countries across the world, certainly this is true in the United States, but countries across the world will simply look much older in the years to come. When we walk down the street, we will see more old people than young people. The demographic Venn diagram used to go like this. I mean, it used to be a pyramid, right? A few old people at the top, lots of young people at the bottom. It now looks like a cylinder or a rectangle. It will, in the years to come, look like a reverse pyramid. And what that means is institutions across society. I mentioned academic institutions, but this is true of workplaces. It's true of cities and health systems and cultural institutions. Everything has to change to adapt to the new demographic reality. And we think about this we've thought about it in the context of the demographic changes in the United States over the last, number of decades and what's to come. We know, for example, America will be, I live in a majority minority state. Even in Wyoming in years to come, we will see more and more faces of color relative to faces that are white. We sometimes talk about this, by the way, as the brown and the gray.
Yes, right.
A population increasingly of young people who are brown and old people who are white and gray. But the truth of the matter is we've spent a lot of time talking about gender diversity, racial diversity, et cetera, not a lot of time talking about age diversity. And aging is the one thing we all have in common if we're lucky, and it will change societies across the world. Already changing our politics. We can talk at some point about the discussions about gerontocracy, and we can certainly talk about some people's criticism of what are termed entitlement costs and the impacts on younger generations. Right, right. But the point is, this is going to change everything.
It's happening.
I promise you, it's happening today. It's happening before our eyes, and it's already affecting many countries. China, they migrated from the one child policy to the two child policy to the three child policy. The three child policy is failing. What we know is China will have a smaller population at the end of the century than it does today. And the impacts of that older population on the Chinese economy, on peace and infrastructure, intergenerational relations, and all the rest are incredibly important. Again, just an example. So that's the macro view. And the micro view is, for most of human history, David, I mean, before the later part of the 19th century, average lives were in the range of 20, 30, 40 years. So we've added, in effect, in the last 150 years, we doubled longevity. and yet our expectations, our planning really hasn't changed. So the notion of someone, for example, thinking about retiring, I mean, David Bryan, who looks very healthy to me, and I suspect stays very healthy. I know enough
it's
about
the miracles of,
miracles of life and science. David Bryan has a long pathway in front of him. What will be the next thing he should do? So the point is, we have to invent all of our institutions, but we also have to invent the way we think about our own life course. It's not, again, Venn diagrams, right? It's not this thing where you are born and you kind of learn, and you work, and then you start maybe even in your 50s, this long, inexorable decline, being sidelined, losing friends and all the rest, leaving work, this long, inexorable decline to death. It really should be this much more kind of woven DNA-like strand where you go in and out of learning environments, in and out of work, prepare for multiple careers. We don't know. Death rates remain consistent at 100%. We're not going to live forever, but this gives us potentially more time to do more things, and frankly, to think about legacy, to think about purpose, which I've written a lot about. Look, I think in many ways the extension of average lives is the greatest scientific accomplishment of all time. I often say that science has done its part. We know how to live healthier if we applied it. We know what policy should be if we were smart. We're not. But social sciences has really failed because we have no idea what to do with these additional years, and we have no idea what policies and practices need to be changed to realize the potential that science has provided us.
So you mentioned just in passing a moment ago, age and ageism. And I know that when I was teaching economics at UC Santa Cruz after New Roads, and all these young economists about to go launch into the workplace, and there was an attitude, I wouldn't say it was vehement and vitriolic, but it was there about finding a job in a world where people who have already had their careers are sort of just are hanging on. And that's interesting, especially now. And I did not know that the demographic at the younger ages were, you know, there was a shrinking younger population rather than a growing younger population. But that's there, right? I mean, and is that an attitude that needs turning around? I mean, obviously hate of any sort needs turning around, but is that prevalent? Is that, or is that changing as well? I mean, we see it in the presidential situation.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think ageism is in many ways the last acceptable ism. It's the last ism that people talk about publicly. Obviously,
yeah,
we can talk later if you want about Joe Biden, but it's part of the daily discourse when people talk about our president.
Yeah,
it was part of the daily discourse and will be again about one of my two senators, one of your formerly two senators, Dianne Feinstein.
Sure. Right.
So you know, the answer is that that ageism shouldn't be acceptable, and what there should be is recognition that people can contribute in meaningful ways at all ages, and that contribution and potential should be based on individual characteristics and the like, and not about broad generalizations that are routinely not true. I mean, it is true, David. By the way, despite the fact that I'm in the business of fighting ageism, it is true that age is the principal risk factor for chronic disease. There's no debating that. It is true that about a third of people 80 plus have some significant form of cognitive loss. And it's true that about half of people 85 plus have some level of dementia, but what that means is that half don't, right?
Right. Right.
So.
Well,
so
it means two things. Not only to half don't, but although our understanding of the science of aging has improved greatly, the implementation, right? But both on a macro policy level and individual, like people know what's. Look, I shouldn't really be doing this, but they keep doing it. So
yes, they do keep doing it, and we can talk later about you know, healthy behaviors and things like that, incentives, you know, behavioral economics and all the rest. But
yeah.
Look,
yeah,
the bottom line is this. I mean, of course we should ensure that young people have opportunity, and young people should ensure that older people have opportunity. And we should all be generous in our positions, right? I mean, I've now moved beyond leadership in the center I created. It's now passed down to the next generation. She's absolutely wonderful. The person who's running it, Dianne Tai, is her name. And so I've done that twice in my life. And I think you have to, without fear, be in a position to move away and move to new things. But what that doesn't mean is that you should be sidelined, that you should seen as in the state of decline, diminishment, irrelevance, et cetera. What it means is there are always new doors and you should be walking through them.
Well, another question is, are there indeed new doors, or Should there be new doors, but because we are not so wise about this, there really aren't enough new doors for older people to walk through. At least, you know, I mean, you and I are in a position, we're not living from paycheck to paycheck or wondering where the next meal is coming from or anything like that. And a bunch of people are.
We're white guys who had academic opportunity and had the opportunity to have good and valuable jobs that compensated us fairly and that presented us opportunity. And David, let's just be blunt about it. No, is that available to all people? Absolutely not. Right. And should it be? Again, this gets back to my point about things like lifelong learning, ensuring that we have opportunities for people to work and contribute in new ways. And by the way, not to work in the same way that they've worked in the past, because again, you've been in your life involved in cerebral activity, the kind of activity that one can do much later in life. If you and I have been in the business of, you know, schlepping stuff and throwing on trucks, and we had bad backs and sore legs and arms, that's not the kind of thing that we could easily be doing in our 60s, 70s and 80s. So we have the need, and I think we have the opportunity and ability to ensure that everybody has opportunity. Are we a society that engages in, I've written about longevity in inequality. I'd love to talk about that at some point. But the same kinds of biases, expectations, opportunity challenges, et cetera, exist for older people, for example, older people of color, older women of color in particular, people who've been involved in physical labor, people who don't have the benefit and blessing of college education, et cetera. And we need to change it.
Right. I mean, that was, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was one of the things on this piece of paper you can't see. But indeed, it's a, you know, it also, one of the things, this may not even be a fair question, but that's okay. We're friends. You know, there is that sense, which I like to think is true, that sometimes as people get older, they get, you know, experience a lot comes with experience, and sometimes it gets spoken about as wisdom or something like that. And I'm wondering if society has changed in such a way, the speed of the things going on, the shaping of our world in all of its forms by increasing acceleration, you know, is it a world where age and wisdom matters? Are we making a world where it doesn't?
I've been bypassed. So I'm going to make the flip side argument. It's a really good question. Is the world moving too fast? And yeah, there are plenty of times when, you know, I listen to somebody talking about ChatGPT and I hold my head in my hands and I say, you know, I say, I want to go back to landline phones and old-fashioned TV. But here's my counter argument. Okay, think about the economy. So we moved from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy. We've now very much in our midlives and late and later lives, we moved from an industrial economy to a knowledge economy. Look at where capital markets are. Look what the dominant companies are. But let me tell you something, and my friends who are advocates of things like Girls Who Code may jump on me for this, but I would actually argue that many of the things that are done in the world of technology are the most easy things for example, AI and emerging technologies, machine learning, et cetera, to replace. The most difficult thing for those things to replace are the synapses that make us, as a result of our age and experience and wisdom, able to see across sectors, to engage in multi-sectoral problem solving and opportunity creation, to see and understand nuance and complexity in ways that we didn't when we were 30. And yes, we were more energetic, and yes, we were more physically able. But so my assertion is the next economy
is a wisdom economy. The next economy is an economy that moves beyond the things that we know that machines and robots and all the rest can do, to something that's uniquely human. It's not to say that can't ultimately be replaced as well. Sure. We don't know. Right. Right? I mean, who the heck knows how the world is going to be in 50 or 100 years? I think about my grandson, and I can't imagine what he's going to be dealing with. But at least in the foreseeable future, I think what we know is that the things, the way we think, the way we look at a problem, is actually harder for a machine to replace than many of the functions that really, really smart kids are engaged in, who have degrees in engineering and computer science from MIT and Caltech and Stanford. So there.
I like that argument.
I mean, well, you should. It's about us.
I hope it's true.
I hope it's true too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's two things at the same time, maybe. But one is, you know, the mountain you've just drawn, the mountain that lies ahead that you've just drawn a sketch of, is awesome.
It's awesome.
It is. I mean, you're speaking about a set of policy changes and just attitude changes and, you know, perception changes that are sort of, in some ways, they are imaginable, but not really.
There's nothing in human history that informs it.
Yes.
There's nothing in human history that informs it. It'd be like saying, showing somebody from the 16th century an airplane and saying, what do we do with this
thing? Which color lights should be on?
Exactly. What does this thing do? So again, in the thousands and thousands of years of history, culture, work norms, relationship norms, health expectations, et cetera. There's nothing that has prepared us for this new reality of aging. It's neither, again, the demographic, the macro question, the way society will look, or the personal question, what should our lives look like? And so we have the opportunity to invent it.
Two things, and you can answer them together or separately, but are there places that are doing it right, or at least offering models for how to do it right? And are you hopeful?
You know, the funny thing is, immediately before, I feel like this, I promised the audience, I did not tee up this question. I had no idea you were going to ask it. Literally, David, the moment before I got on with you today, I was on with the CEO of Blue Zones. Do you know about Blue Zones? I'll tell you about Blue Zones. So Blue Zones was a concept developed by a writer adventurer named Dan Buettner a number of years ago, and well, he wrote about it. I bet there'll be many people watching, listening to this, who know about Blue Zones. He wrote about it in National Geographic, and has since written books and all the rest. And his notion was, there are these places around the world, Sardinia,
yes,
et cetera, that for some reason people live extraordinarily, unusually long lives.
Yes,
characteristics of these places. What made them unique? Did they have common denominators? And how could the learnings from observing these places be applied much more broadly?
Yeah.
By the way, there happens to be, and I'm going to test you, and I'm guessing you might not know the answer to it, but there is one blue zone in the United States, one that Dan originally identified, and the answer is Loma Linda, California.
What?
I knew you'd say what.
You're going to tell me Montana or South Dakota.
Right, no. So Loma Linda, California. So Loma Linda is a Seventh-day Adventist town. And by the way, so it has a fantastic health system. So what are the characteristics of people in Loma Linda? And I'm not advocating this for you or I, but it's something we can learn from. They don't drink coffee. They don't drink booze. They don't smoke.
They have extraordinarily low divorce rates. They have nuclear families that are very tight, long work lives, a terrific health system, a walkable community, and a lot of focus on health, deep social relationships and social engagement and faith. So it's not to say that all of us, and certainly I wouldn't want to live there. And it's those are not necessarily behaviors that I would want to generally adopt. But what we can learn from that are things that can be extrapolated to and understood in the context of the lives that many of the rest of us live. So whether it's principally plant-based diets or people, you know, in running up in the Greek hills chasing their sheep, or people who live in intergenerational communities where they're connected not just to their own children but to other young people in the community and who are engaged and who are valued for their wisdom, judgment, perspective, et cetera, sought out as village elders. Those are the kinds of things that can be more broadly adopted and applied. And what they can lead to is not just longer lives, but much more important, better lives, and compression between mortality and morbidity, the extension of health span, a much shorter time in which we live.
Degenerate.
Very sick people right. die, right?
Right.
So everybody should take a look at Blue Zones. It's really
interesting. I didn't remember the name, but I did in fact read about that years ago. I did not remember Loma Linda House.
Yeah. So yeah, kind of surprising. But again, you know, it's not to say that you or I want to live that way. If I had to live without my cup of coffee in the morning, I'd be in deep trouble. But there are other things that we can learn about it. So social engagement, intergenerational connection, lifelong learning.
Well, that seems to be the one those two, but especially the, you know, connection to other human beings seems to be the one that, you know, it seems to be the common refrain about well-being and happiness and, you know, all the things that people seem to want, whether they're walking around the block, but if they've got connections to other human beings, that seems to be the
people. You know, people see it as somehow, for some reason, I think very wrongly, as some soft factor, something that's warm and fuzzy and not really. Right. Vivek Murthy, for anybody who's watching this, Vivek Murthy, our Surgeon General, just put out a brand new report, really important.
Yes,
report
about loneliness.
On loneliness and loneliness as a public health risk. And by the way, he routinely speaks about his own battles with loneliness as he was growing up. There's all kinds of evidence that social connection is integrally connected with good health, with longer lives. And with healthy behavior. So and look, it's a challenge for us as we get older, because if we think about the nature of relationship development when we're kids, it's kind of obvious, right? And as we're going through school, and then we get jobs and we meet new people through our jobs.
If we have
children, when our children are I met David Bryan as a result of
I was a parent.
Right. And then what happens is these things start to winnow away, right?
Yes.
Kids grow up, friends die or move away.
Right.
Some move to Wyoming. We have work lives stop. Friendships change, right. and so these broad relationship networks start to narrow, and we really must put ourselves in a position to meet new people, to experience new things. It's not just nice; it's necessary. It's something that we have to do for our health, and we have to again encourage our institutions to enable people to have those experiences.
What's that? You know, it's that one that keeps gnawing back here. Is the You know, obviously there are certain fronts on which aging and well-being has advanced dramatically. You mentioned the science, right? I mean, medical science is it's extraordinary, really, what's come about. And then there are places where there are arenas, whether it's social or psychological or economic or, where it's like no one's paid attention to that at all. A lot of energy has been put on, or a lot. I'm not sure if it's been put on gerontology, but because of where medical energy has gone, we've learned a lot about how to extend somebody's life, but have not, almost stridently, have not thought about those other things. And,
and look, this is not just about old people. I mean, it's how we start oftentimes affects how we finish, right? So this is life that we're stuck. The sad and frustrating thing for people in my world is, it's very much something that we push against, and something I know you would agree with. We spend about 90% of our federal health budget on treatment and care, something that in the United States is relatively ineffective. We spend about 5%, maybe a little bit less, on prevention and wellness, the thing we know works, and about 5% on research and cure, which is about the advancement of science. So the answer is we way underinvest in prevention. And you know what we know, for example, is we talk about pandemics. We have a type 2 diabetes pandemic, not just in the U.S. but in many other parts of the world, and a whole series of things that are related to that. I mean, look, if nothing else, I sent you a few articles about it. If nothing else, in the context of the pandemic of COVID, what we learned is that public health measures and preventative measures could have saved thousands and thousands and thousands of lives, but particularly lives in communities of color, and particularly lives in low-income communities, doing things like intervention for hypertension, for high blood pressure, relatively easy to do, relatively inexpensive, relatively easy to monitor, particularly a risk in the African-American community in the United States. There are things that we could have done and could do today to dramatically reduce risk to people who are affected by hypertension. We just don't do it, you know? So what we need is advocacy for public health measures, and we need much more investment in preventative infrastructure, intervention, advocacy, et cetera. And if we did, we would have healthier people, and not just healthier people who look like you and I, but healthier people in communities that are underserved in the United States.
So you spoke about blue zones. That was part of the question, that one half of that question. The other was, are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful because you have
a hopeful guy.
I'm a glasses half full guy. I'm a hopeful guy. Look, again, you know, you tend to see these things through your own prism, but I've seen just in the time I've done this. So you know, I radically switched careers 13 years ago, right? In the time I've done this, I've seen way more attention to this, way more focus on it, not just in the U.S., but across the world, initiatives from the WHO, the UN. I recently served on the National Academy of Medicine Commission that issued a report on healthy longevity that we're trying to get out and push in, not just in policy environments, but in business environments, work environments. I think that there's more attention, but so I think things are moving. They're just not moving anywhere near quickly enough. You know, when you do this work, you think about what were the inflection points in movement, because it really is about movement building, right? What's, you know, but let's face it, you and I both know the Civil Rights Act of 1964 didn't end racism, and the modern women's movement.
Really?
Isn't that shocking? You thought it was all done. You know, modern women's movement, you know, what, 50 years ago or so now, you know, the early women's movement was so focused on suffrage. More modern women's movement was more focused on things like pay parity. There's still not pay parity. So it takes a long time to change things. A long time. You know, the LGBT, we thought in the LGBTQ movement, which moved, by the way, very quickly.
Unbelievable.
I think maybe in some ways, sadly, resulting from the AIDS crisis. But, you know, so we had marriage equality and all the rest. And here we are, 2023, and we got people pushing backwards, right? So it takes a long time to change hearts and minds. And you know, you got to keep working on it. Tilting the windows or making a little movement.
You know? I'm glad you're hopeful. I And I certainly try to be about all sorts of things. And, you know, I take seriously what you said at the beginning, and I suspect you're right that, you know, there's climate change, which we're not doing so well at. And then in number two position is this. And, you know, I will bet, you know, unless I travel in your circles, I'll bet if I ask, you know, if I ask 25 people, what are the pressing crises? There's one or two who I know would say, yeah, you know, what are we going to do about all this, the demographic change going on in the world with respect to age? And so I will try to be hopeful.
I mean, there is one piece of good news about this, and I mentioned it before, and that is that unlike race or politics or gender,
yes,
this is our combat.
There's no escape.
Yeah. There's no escape. This is the one and only thing.
We're aging, right?
Yeah.
So when
we were talking about, you know, it's like on the tip of everybody's tongue, mine included, you know, would I want there to be a younger president? Well, you know, sometimes, absolutely, but you know, poor Joe, he's changing a lot of things, and I think in the right direction oftentimes, and on the tip of everybody's tongue is how old he is, and Trump is only 3 years younger.
Who was it that they called the Teflon Don? Right? I mean, for some reason, he avoids the conversation unbelievably. Who was it? Was it I have to get this right for my former head of school, but was it Fitzgerald or somebody who said the sign of intelligence is keeping two conflicting notions in your mind at the same time? So here's the conflicting notion on Joe Biden, right? So on the one hand, for those in my world who may want to deny this, he is physically slower. He has kind of a stiff gait. He's never been the world's greatest public speaker. His public speaking has probably gotten worse.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Right, stuff associated with aging. On the other hand, very likely his experience, you know, the decades in the Senate, his ability to schmooze people and to get along, his understanding of how to pace change, his age and experience probably lent to success and accomplishing some really significant bipartisan achievements, and maybe in some senses the most important achievements some people say since FDR, right?
Yes.
Maybe even more significant achievements than the world's most charismatic and handsome and energetic guy, Barack Obama, or than Bill Clinton in his prime.
Yeah.
The answer is you can keep both of those things in your mind, right? Yes. There are downsides associated with getting old. There are upsides associated with it. And we should be able to understand both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that crazy?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think Biden is a really good example of it. You know, so there are people who will, you know, who don't like the policies. So I'm not talking about people who, no matter what he does, you know, it's always going to be the wrong thing, right? So, okay, you don't like those policies and whatever, but in terms of effectiveness,
right?
It's just he's kind of been extraordinary, and yeah, exactly about those things. He's obviously older. I'm sure he would admit it. His walk, his gait is definitely compromised in certain situations. You know, he stumbles. He stumbles both verbally and otherwise. And so, yeah, okay.
But the important thing is for those who, for some reason, are only concerned with a president's charisma, ability to articulate his, you know, and all the rest, don't lose sight of the importance of getting shit done.
Exactly. Right? You know, show me the beef. Show me the money. Where's the beef?
Right.
Yeah. So what else? If I knew what I was talking about, what would we be talking about? What's important for us to speak about?
Well, I
want to be respectful.
I mentioned longevity inequality before, and I think one thing that's important for all of us to think about is
is what I consider really the ultimate injustice. So we talk a lot about income inequality in America, as we should, and we talk about educational inequality. What we don't talk about enough is the fact that from one zip code in Chicago to another, people live average lives 30 years different. In virtually every big city in the United States, in Los Angeles, in New York, in Atlanta, in Seattle, you name Houston, you name it, people across town, oftentimes in communities of color, routinely in communities that are low income, live much shorter lives. And there are lots and lots of complex reasons for this. You know about social determinants of health. we could spend an hour talking about that, which we won't. But what that means is that, and I talked about the beauty of what science has given us. For those of us who live on the west side of Los Angeles, or who live on the upper west side of New York, or who live in an advanced society or advanced part of Wyoming, we really have the opportunity to reap the benefits of potentially longer lives, of longer health spans, and all the rest. And most of the citizens of these underserved places really don't. I mean, David, we talk a lot about, you've heard many times, talk a lot about the paradox that in the United States, we have the smartest science, the best academic institutions, incredibly advanced medicine, and yet our outcomes are terrible relative to our peers. You've heard this many times, right? Sure. So people say, why is it? Why is it that we have the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic and Harvard University and MD Anderson and all the rest, and yet for some reason, Americans live shorter lives and less healthy lives? And there are lots of reasons for that, but one of the, this is back to kind of generalization and lack of real insight. If you dig down in that, the truth of the matter is that I probably have about as good, close to as good health opportunity as my counterpart in Norway or Switzerland, right, or Japan. But across town,
right,
my counterpart has access to health information, health skill.
Right.
It's probably about the same as his or her counterpart in Niger.
Right. Right.
That says something about America. So I think long way of saying that I think one of the things that our aging population compels us to do is to have the conversation about American values. We just got through July 4th, right? Have the conversation about American values that we really don't want to have. And that is are we really this country of self-sufficient, independent people who have no responsibility to the collective good, to the common interest, but only to ourselves and our immediate family? Or do we have a broader obligation to the public health, general welfare, education, et cetera, of our fellow citizens? You know where I fall on this. It's pretty obvious.
I was about to say, but I'm glad you're still Paul Irving.
Yeah, but the answer is it's time for that conversation, because again, population aging is elevating the realities and I think increasing the urgency of that question. It's really outrageous. I mean, I see this because I travel to underserved communities to see what's going on, to see how their older people live, to see the medical care that they get or don't get, health. To understand the impacts of food deserts and poor nutrition, to understand the fact that in many cases they can't even walk. So I'm wearing a Fitbit. I'm concerned about my 10,000 steps a day. They can't even walk because of the lack of safety in their neighborhoods. So are we okay with that or not? I think, I listened to your conversation with Bill Ayers, kind of talking about, I think you express the fact that you weren't a pacifist, right? That there's sometimes when stronger action than mere advocacy is needed. I think we're at kind of an inflection point. I mean, I think, I won't give the last president much credit, but I will give him credit for this. I think he's raised awareness about the question about what America is and will America be what we hope it will be and should be. And you know, look, all of us have a responsibility to advocate and to vote and to participate and to support those who need our support. Where it comes out, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I guess I have to, you know, I'm a grandfather, right? I have to be hopeful.
Totally.
Or else I have to leave.
I prefer to be hopeful.
We're at a fraught time. We're at a fraught time. How do you feel about it? Let me turn the tables. Are you hopeful? How do you feel about it?
Am I hopeful? I am naively hopeful. I think being hopeful is one of those things that is important to well-being. And Howard Zinn used to say, whether you succeed or not is in some ways doing that is at the very least interesting and rewarding. You know, it's why I started doing this. It's like, what am I going to do? Am I going to play golf? I don't like golf. Whatever.
It's process. I know you said it about education, right? That you know, you go through these kind of agonizing times, and then one kid comes back to campus and says, you know how you changed my life, and that carries you for another 10 years.
Oh, my God. You know, living on
campus. Yeah. Right. I mean, so, you know, one of the things I do, and I think one of the things that I advocate for is intergenerational connection. And I think a hopeful thing is that there are an unbelievable number of wonderful, amazing, active young people who are engaged in social change advocacy, new kinds of work, new kinds of relationship, and new kinds of thinking. And by the way, you know, you could say to yourself, gee, this is great for them because we bring, you know, mentorship and wisdom and advice and all the rest. Truth of the matter is there's all kinds of evidence that it's not just good for our head, it's good for the rest of us. There's a famous study out of Johns Hopkins about something called Experience Corps, which was actually birthed at Encore.org and is now run under the aegis of AARP. And what they did is they studied older adult volunteers in classrooms. And of course, not surprisingly, they found that children benefited by having these older people around, but that it was good for their health. The AmeriCorps, which was the Corporation on National and Community Service, has research on online. People could take a look at it. They studied the impact of things like what was Senior Corps, foster grandparents, now AmeriCorps seniors, on the volunteers. And what they found is improved cardiovascular health, cognitive health, osteoarthritic health. So the bottom line is hanging around with young people and working with young people is
best thing.
It reinforces that sense of hope. It reinforces the notion that the world can go on despite, you know, January 6th and all the rest.
Yeah.
And guess what? There's a side benefit. It's actually good for us. And by the way, and Wyoming is a really interesting test case. Smallest population in the United States, most open space.
Yes. That's true. All that's true.
Two senators, one congressperson. You know, so it's kind of an extraordinary place. And there are communities in Wyoming, in small states like this, that are being hollowed out by aging, right?
Yes.
Where people are aging alone, where young people have left for opportunity. So one of the questions for places like Wyoming is, how do you create these vibrant small communities where young people will want to come interact with the older people,
right,
to build new economies, new opportunities, and all the rest?
That is a challenge. That really is a challenge. I think
it is. Yeah.
You know, I live in Powell, Wyoming, which is a small, it's really a farm ranch town, and it's definitely got an aging population. And you know, there are little kids around, but I'm not sure how many stay. A lot of them go and then want to come back because there are things many of the virtues of Loma Linda, as you were describing it, you know, are happening here.
And I would challenge Wyoming to think about this. How do you make this a place where, because of relatively low expense, housing expense, because of open spaces, because of good air, and all the rest, you also create a vibrant economic environment there.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great seeing you, man.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.